Hello, everybody, and welcome to everybody who's in person, just coming in, and online at this Institute for Government event looking at AI and disinformation and the threat it poses to elections in the UK and worldwide. And some of you will just be switching over from watching Oliver Dowden and his statement in Parliament about the threat from Chinese cyber hacking. Not exactly the theme we're going to do today, but anyway, we're looking at other sources of threats to the election. And can I thank in particular the University of Lancaster for sponsoring this event. I'm Jill Rutter, I'm a senior fellow here at the Institute for Government. So, general election, less than a year away, it really has to be in the next 10 months or so. But one of the big differences since 2019 is the rise of artificial intelligence. We weren't talking about AI at all at the time of the 2019 election. Now it's really, really emerging as quite a big theme. It's got a lot of range of users, and some of you will have played with it so far. But one that's causing a lot of concern is how AI can produce fake information, both by facilitating the rapid production of misleading text, as well as deep fake videos. And some of you will have seen an interview that John Pullinger from the Electoral Commission gave to the Financial Times about a month or so ago, maybe slightly longer, about some of the worries about deep fake videos there. That can make politicians, other trusted figures, appear to say and do things that never happened, and more generally just undermine people's faith in the integrity of everything that they're seeing. So a YouGov poll commissioned by the communications consultancy Cavendish found that some 70% of MPs worry that AI will increase the spread of disinformation. So we've seen lots of it, some of you will have seen it, whether it's Sadiq Khan, Keir Starmer, you know, faked robocall impersonating Joe Biden sent to voters before a primary election. Seems a bit of a waste of your AI, frankly, in the States, given that he was really the only candidate, but anyway. Numbers of AI-enhanced images of politicians increasing. So we've got elections worldwide, a big year of elections, but we've also got countries around the world grappling with AI and that threat, whatever. So that's what we're going to look at today as part of the Institute for Government's general election programme. So I'm joined by a fantastic panel. Professor Joe Burton, on my immediate left, Professor of International Security in the Department of Politics, Philosophy and Religion at Lancaster University. On my far left, Louise Edwards, Director of Regulation and Digital Transformation at the Electoral Commission. On my immediate right, Chris Morris, who many of you will have known as the face of BBC Reality Check, but has now morphed into the chief executive of Full Fact, the UK's leading fact-checking charity.
We are a charity. Yes.
I think you say. Well, you battle quite a long time to get charitable status, so it's quite important to remind that. And last but by no means least, Dr. Simon Staffel, the UK Government Affairs Manager at Microsoft. So we've got the regulator, the industry, the independent fact checkers, and academic expertise all represented on our super duper panel. So before we get going, some brief housekeeping notes. Ask questions if you've come here. You can put up your hand in the conventional old-fashioned way, but if you're watching us online, please enter your questions in through Slido. If you feel able to, offer your name. If you don't, you know, and we know who some of you are, just say anonymous and we'll assume you're all civil servants or Louise's colleagues from the Electoral Commission. We'll be live tweeting along from at IFG events. If you want to do that, use the rather clunky hashtag, hashtag IFG general election. You can follow along. Anyway, so we're going to start. I'm going to throw out some pretty softball-y questions to our panel, frankly, and then you can come in, because I'm expecting there to be a lot more expertise in the room than I certainly have. So let's start off with you, Chris. I mean, Chris, last 2019, you were at the BBC. 2024, you're in Full Fact. Full Fact's actually had its work cut out dealing with conventional misleading use of information by politicians. So what do you see are the additional risks from AI to the ones that you've always been worried about, just about people twisting facts, you know, using misleading stats, et cetera, et cetera?
Thanks, Jill. I think the main point is, it's an obvious one, but it's worth emphasising. Generative AI turbocharges everything, both in terms of speed and in terms of scale. And what it's really doing is revolutionising the creation, the production, and the distribution of information. I mean, if you take video deepfakes, only a few years ago, you needed a hell of a lot of computing power to be able to create a convincing video deepfake. Now you can do it on an app on your phone. If you take audio deepfakes, only a few years ago, they sounded a bit like the Daleks had invaded, and they really weren't very good. There were glitches. Now it is virtually impossible to tell when audio is artificially generated. You mentioned the deepfake audios recently of Keir Starmer and of Sadiq Khan. We looked at both of those and we spoke to a lot of audio experts, and none of them could say we have proof that this is artificially generated. So if you're being really kind of particular about it, the best you can say is there is no evidence that this is genuine. But actually proving it's artificially generated is almost impossible and will soon be pretty much completely impossible. And that's, I think, why Labour had a quite public concern about its relationship with Twitter, now X, because X was essentially saying to them, no, we're not going to take that audio down because we cannot prove it is fake. So overall, what this means is that generative AI means there is far more chance of bad information spreading. And I think another impact on elections is, if you like, I suppose I'd call it the reverse risk, because it increases the chance of plausible deniability. And if a politician actually is caught out on a microphone, I'm thinking of Gordon Brown as he sits in his car with his little TV mic still on and forgets it's there, it's going to be much, much easier for politicians to say, no, that's fake, I didn't say that. And to actually prove that it is actually real is also kind of more difficult. So that's a concern. And I think the overall impact means that the bad side of generative AI is that it reduces trust, it decreases legitimacy for politics in general. And I slightly fear with this election that one of the challenges is going to be that everyone is going to be trying so hard to spot the fakes, they forget to focus on what the politicians actually do say. And we've really got to make sure that, you know, some politicians will be speaking in perfectly formed sentences which make sense and stand up to statistical scrutiny. Some of them won't be, and it's really important that we hold politicians to account for what they actually do say. So I think that's important. And then the final point I'd make is that it's also important not just to see AI as a threat. It's a massive opportunity. Generative AI and AI more generally, we have automated fact-checking tools which we've developed over the last few years, which means that fact-checkers have far more chance to deal with bad information because the AI can direct them to the places where they're needed most.
I want to come on to some of the upsides a bit later because I'm in gloom central at the moment. But I just wanted to ask you, in terms of, I mean, do you see it as Full Facts' role to be calling out some of these deep fakes? Or have you trained your fact checkers to do that? I mean, what sort of, you know, tips are you giving people? I remember Full Fact doing some work with people on how to spot some misleading information. I mean, are you offering anything to the public on how to spot deep fakes? Is it not worth it because it's so difficult now?
Well, it's getting more and more difficult, but we were talking about this just before we came on, and Louise's 11-year-old son knows that sometimes hands look a bit weird in deep fake video. So do ears.
Or photographs. And
also, if you slow videos down, you might see the odd glitch here and there. But the point is the technology is improving literally day by day, and it is going to become more and more difficult. And I think we are fairly soon going to be at a point where, just as we are now with audio, it's going to be almost impossible to say that a video has been artificially generated. So then there's obviously a real need for tech companies, for journalists, for everyone really, to make sure that if stuff is, and for politicians in particular, if we're talking about elections, that if stuff is artificially generated, it is very clearly labelled. Now, of course, bad actors, whether they be foreign states or just individuals who seek to do harm, aren't going to label anything, and that's something that we have to deal with.
So, Joe, the UK is not unique in having an election this year. This is sort of election central. Just wondered if you might tell us, you know, is there anything we've learnt from the impact that AI has had so far in other elections in other countries, or indeed from things that other countries are doing to try and tackle a bit of the sort of threat from AI?
Yeah, thanks, Jill. So, I mean, I think the thing that put this on the map for me was the 2016 US presidential election and the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And this was an instance where you had a social media platform, Facebook, essentially being misused by a company to spread via algorithm emotionally charged content in order to influence the US electorate in a way that I think did impact that that election. Now, I'm not saying that the Cambridge Analytica's operations in 2016 enabled Trump to defeat Hillary Clinton, but certainly think that was a good example of the use of algorithms to influence an election by targeting people, you know, with cognitive, emotional content and often actually disinformation, fake or false content. So that was, I think, the election that put it on the map for me. I think actually the transition in the US between 2016 and 2020, people realised that this type of manipulation was possible, and authorities in the United States did a lot more to stop that, including offensive operations targeting the troll farms in Russia that were disseminating some of the disinformation, including putting pressure on the social media companies to take down fictitious groups that were disseminating this information, spreading disinformation. And I think that led to a greater degree of awareness in the US government and globally of the sorts of risks involved to our elections. And I think it also led to, I think, some increased level of corporate responsibility for taking down this content on these platforms. The problem with this is, how do you do that? Do you do it through automated takedown tools? That's very difficult. You need to employ thousands of people to monitor and moderate social media networks to actually effectively take down the false or misleading information. And of course, when you're restricting the information on social media, what we've seen in last years is the political controversies around freedom of speech and political correctness and all this sort of thing. So it's politically and technically a difficult thing to do. So I think that was the election which put it on the map, but I think we've moved on from then. We've seen today with the news about the attacks against the Electoral Commission that we have determined adversaries who are seeking to undermine our electoral systems. Do we think that they will use AI and algorithms to do that? Absolutely. I don't think that they'll forego any kind of technological opportunity to undermine Western democratic systems. So we've got the adversaries that are a problem. We've got the acceleration, which has already been mentioned, in the technology. The technology is becoming much more sophisticated, whether that's deepfakes, synthetic media, the manipulation of text, audio, video, and actually ChatGPT and other platforms as a disinformation generation tool. You can generate through these large language models much more effectively disinformation to spread. So we've got the threat from the adversaries combining with the technological change. We've got, I think, in my opinion, what is a level of corporate irresponsibility, and I'm going to be quite frank about this, in terms of releasing these models into the wild, into the market, without really doing due diligence on the risks involved. We know that LLMs are a disinformation tool. You can use them to reverse engineer malware. They have cybersecurity implications to sow discord. And I'm afraid that the commercial imperatives, the need to beat competitors, the release of these products at the moment, to me, is overriding security concerns. And I think as we move into the future, that combination of determined adversaries, the technological change, the lack of attention to security in the corporate sector is going to combine to create an even bigger and heightened risk to our electoral processes.
So what's the adversary's objective in this? Is it to promote the interests of, you know, a party that they think is softer on them or less likely to invest in defence or conventional defences? Or is it just to basically have, you know, a population that's, you know, thinking democracy's a bit of a rubbish system and I don't trust any of these guys or whatever? Are there differences if you look at, you know, potential bad actors, what they want to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, I think that their thinking is quite sophisticated and targeted based on specific elections. So in 2016, Russian interference in the US election was clearly in favour of Donald Trump, and Putin had made an evaluation at that point, I think, that a Trump victory would be much better in terms of US foreign policy towards Russia. So in that context, I think there was quite a specific electoral objective. That's obviously not the case in all elections. I mean, the election here, are we going to have a particularly different foreign policy position on Ukraine, whether it's Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer in number 10? I don't think that there's that level of difference on foreign policy that exists here. So in those circumstances, I think it becomes more, on the part of the adversaries, a process really to just weaken democracy, to sow mistrust, to sow discord, to have us fighting with each other about contentious political issues, and the AI and the algorithms will be used around those catalyst trigger issues, whether it's, you know, racial or ethnic tensions, Palestine, the war in Ukraine. They will be used as triggers to sow discord and division within our political systems. And there doesn't have to be a specific motive for that. That's beneficial to countries like China and Russia who want to weaken Western democracies.
So just mayhem, basically. Louise, the Electoral Commission's the election regulator here, so we've heard about the potential threats and risks. And what is the Electoral Commission doing to protect the next general election against those risks?
Well, I mean, first of all, with the role of the Electoral Commission, we are here to try and ensure that elections in the UK are well run and to maintain the overall integrity of the election and democratic system. And we're also a financial regulator. So much of our work is actually about political finance. The reason I mention that is because when it comes to the content of political campaigning, so the actual content of leaflets or online campaigning or whatever it is, there isn't a very strong or wide-ranging legal framework around that, because actually political discourse is protected. You want good political discourse. And if I want to sort of, you know, trawl back to my philosophy degree, I'd ask, what is truth in the context of political political discourse? But I'll start off just with, actually, I'm going to go against your doom and gloom start with just a couple of good
You're allowed
points
to do that.
And then come back to the specific risks. One thing I just want to highlight is, you know, if we think about the general election, there is going to be thousands of candidates standing for election and lots of campaigners for them and for political parties. There are around 400 registered political parties in the UK, so lots and lots of parties out there campaigning, lots of third parties, so charities and others out there campaigning as well. And the overwhelming majority of all of them are doing it because they want to help improve their society. They'll have different ideas about how to do that, but that's why they're there. And it's really important that we do protect their ability to go out and campaign, whether it's online or on the streets. The other thing I'll just say very briefly is we have very high levels of public confidence in the voting process in this country as well. And I think that's really important, that people know that they can go and cast their vote with confidence. But to turn to the specific risks, there are some very old risks here and there are some very new risks. And I think it's quite important to differentiate between them. Now, it has always been the case, probably back to the very start of democracy, that voters need to think critically about the information that's being given to them to try and influence their vote. They need to be a bit savvy. They need to look at this stuff with a critical eye. And that's always been the case. Now, what we saw in 2016, for us it was the EU referendum rather than the American election, was the beginning of the rise of online digital campaigning and a new way for voters to have to think critically about the material that they saw online. And actually, the work that we did to understand voter concerns in 2016, 17, 18 consistently showed that voters were really concerned about the legitimacy, the veracity of information that they saw online. Now we've got a new step change in that technology, and I do agree that it is a step change because of things like speed, scale, availability, cheapness of using models, which many of which are free to access, and there's a lot more opportunity to do new and developing campaign tactics or campaign material and to spread it very quickly online. So voters have to make a step change again to think critically again about how this material looks to them. And I do think, and I won't go into it here, but we can come back to it. I think literacy around this, raising awareness around how to think critically about this sort of material, whether it's AI generated or potentially AI generated, I think is really, really important. The last thing I'll just briefly mention now is I think this is a problem that a lot of people are going to have to work together to solve. You know, there's obviously us and we are looking at elections specifically, but there's also a really big question around the social media platforms and those who generate the AI models themselves about the usage policies they put in place and how they enforce those usage policies to try and ensure they are thinking about their impact on our democratic system. There's also a lot of work that campaigners themselves need to do and political parties themselves need to do to think ethically about how they are using the new tools that are available to them. And there's a big piece of work, I think, for governments to do, not just the UK government, but governments internationally, to think what kind of framework do they want to put around these technologies. And the very last thing I'll say is just that, you know, we have seen that adversaries or foreign interference or those we should be concerned about outside the UK can use AI to try and speed up their attacks and make them better. But we can also use AI to protect ourselves. And certainly since the Commission was the victim of a complex cyber attack, we have, as you would expect, invested quite heavily in our cyber security. And a lot of that is driven by AI techniques. So it is an opportunity. It is a good thing, as well as something that can be used in a bad way.
Thank you very much, Louise. Simon, Joe was putting you a bit on the spot there, saying that maybe the tech companies have been quite irresponsible in letting these tools out into the wild before there was a decent regulatory framework, sort of properly tested. So I noted that you, the Microsoft, were one of the signatories to something that was released at the Munich Security Conference, which makes 8 specific commitments on how you're going to help with AI. So what should we be expecting the tech companies to do?
Sure. Thank you, Jill, and thanks very much for having me. So as many of us have been exploring the opportunity this generative AI technology creates, and we're doing that with customers all over the country and everywhere in every country at the moment. Unfortunately, bad actors have been doing that as well. And so we've been seeing that experimentation and then moving into now activity where, as we've all seen in the examples that you've given, Jill, bad actors are using this now to increasing potential impact. And so we do think that it's absolutely Microsoft's responsibility and the responsibility of any company that's deploying these technologies, that's developing these technologies, to do so using a responsible approach. And we have our responsible AI program within Microsoft to do that. But also that we have a particularly critical moment at the moment with the convergence of the acceleration of that technology and a year in which there are 3/4 of the world's democracies voting. So absolutely focused on this, and that you know, came through in the tech accord, which I will absolutely happy to talk a bit more about. But fundamentally, and I think Louise also made an important point, that AI and technology needs to be a part of the solution here. I think that is absolutely critical. And so we see our role as being part of that solution and defence that AI needs to provide, given that companies like Microsoft, working with governments like in the UK, are actually leading in developing some of these technologies. So I think solution and defence is absolutely critical. But we also have to look at this in the context in which democracies are clearly being under attack consistently in the cyber and the information domain. We've seen that today. You know, this is on a weekly basis now. So we have to look through from the cybersecurity context into the information operations, of which AI and deepfakes is now a part. It's a relatively small part when we look at that wider context, but it's growing and it's important that we focus on it. And so at Microsoft, we have something called our Democracy Forward program, which is looking at everything from providing cybersecurity tools to parliamentarians through to supporting local journalism to information literacy campaigns as part of that protection of what fundamentally is an attack on democracy. More specifically, in relation to deepfakes, I think our responsibility as a sector, as a company, starts from understanding the challenge, because we do have a unique insight into the technology and also the sort of the data and the threat landscape that we're seeing. And so we've done a lot of work, not just in relation to deepfakes, but over a period of years now, looking at tracking and assessing cybersecurity threats coming from nation states into the information operations space. And we need to keep updating that as the threat is evolving and as AI is being added to that threat landscape. Many of the elements of what the tech sector is doing are fairly diverse. So, and we've alluded to this, we've got model developing companies, we've got cloud providers who are providing compute to those model developing companies, we've got social media companies, which are platforms for the tech. So there's a wide and diverse ecosystem of companies that are involved here. And so that's why I think initiatives like the Tech Accord in February at the Munich Security Conference are really important, because that brings together a whole range of companies with different roles in this ecosystem, all committing to a series of actions. So there's 20 companies in total. And so what the Tech Accord says, briefly perhaps to outline it, and perhaps we can dig into the detail later. So the Tech Accord talks about tackling prevention, so addressing the creation of the deep fakes. That's through things like the safety architecture we put in place around the models and the applications that they are that they're deployed in. It's through things like content provenance. So C2PA is a standard people might have heard of, this idea of content provenance and watermarking of content so that people have a technical means to authenticate. There's a set of initiatives around detection of the content and then detection of how the content is distributed. Addressing deepfakes that are detected, so that's about reporting and then takedown of material. And then a whole set of initiatives around transparency and resilience. And I think, again, this touches on a point that Louise made around civil society is absolutely critical to this, because there is never a better example of a technological and social issue coming together here. And so with standards like C2PA, with provenance, it absolutely relies on people understanding that that authentication technology exists, and then the pull through into wider understanding and literacy. And we see that we've got an important role in that. And I think just finally, the impact of all these efforts is really important. And we evaluate what's impactful, what's not in the deepfake space. And we don't yet know what the impact of the future activity is going to be. And we have to keep mindful of that. And as we're building resilience through all these initiatives, we've got the opportunity at the moment to blunt attempts. And I think we need to be thinking in those terms and optimistically about all of these sectors coming together in partnership to tackle this.
So I was watching a House of a Joint National Security Committee set of hearings, not the one that I think Louise was testifying in this latest session, but there was a lady from Ofcom talking about what they were doing, and Robin Butler, Lord Butler, who used to be Cabinet Secretary, was basically saying, aren't you a bit behind the game, because they were not sort of really doing things until the end of the year. Now, this is a great year of election. You've got all these great commitments in this accord, Simon, but I just wondered how far those were sort of good to go and how far these were just a sort of work of progress, because the Munich Security Conference was in February, I think. So you're doing things like seeking to detect the distribution of this content, seeking to appropriately address. I mean, can we be pretty confident you've got the tools there already and they're up and humming sort of quite well, or are you just all suddenly decide in February you'd better be working on this and it'll be good, but maybe for the 2029 elections?
Yeah, so obviously I can only speak for Microsoft, but from a Microsoft perspective, all of the things that were announced in the Tech Accord in February, and you can see this from all of the detail that we've published alongside it, were things which were ready. So if we think about things like C2PA as a standard that already exists, safety architecture, red teaming and those kind of things. This is things that we would already be doing. The reporting mechanisms, removal mechanisms, the policies around that. So these are all things that we were doing. Now, clearly there's more to do, and particularly when we think about newer programs in civil society, some of those we already have. Some of them are work that we want to do more of. And to the wider point about regulation, there are pieces of regulation like the Online Safety Act, which is going to be really important, but as you say, won't come into effect. So I think part of and there are others, of course, in Europe. There's the Code of Conduct, Code of Practice for Disinformation. There's the Digital Services Act. There are other pieces of regulation that are relevant. There is both the immediate pressing need to do something now, and I think the Tech Accord is really about that sense of urgency that we feel we need to act very quickly. But there's also that longer term. I think there's a lot of positive momentum towards the regulation and the law that needs to sit alongside this as well.
So, Judge, you were saying, didn't think the company's done enough in particular in letting sort of, you know, AI out into the sort of, you know, wilderness or whatever. But do you think there's more that, I mean, if you were writing the Tech Accord, are there things you'd have liked to have added to it that you'd have put more obligations on the companies? Do you think this is sort of pretty good?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly positive progress that we're having these talks and these, you know, communiques at the international level, and the tech sector are talking to each other in terms of AI safety and responsible use of AI. I do see probably a switch more towards this security by design model being implemented across the tech sector. I sometimes wonder why it's taken us so long to get there and actually how effective it's going to be. But this is the emphasis on actually when you're designing and developing the AI system or the model, making sure it's secure at that stage of the development process before it goes out into the market. I think that switch is fundamental, and I agree that the measures are being taken by the tech sector to try and deal with some of this stuff. But I think it needs to be combined with other measures. You know, the tech sector is important. We need to have probably more responsible politics around this type of stuff as well. I think we need to recognise that algorithmic manipulation manipulates something that's already there within our democratic system and our discourse. So it's used again against pre-existing divisions, to exacerbate pre-existing divisions in our society. And I think that there's a role, again, for politicians and political parties to be more responsible when we're dealing with these sorts of incidents, whether it's, you know, deep fakes about what politicians have said, or images that show undesirable things happening in our electoral process. I think there's a level of sort of political responsibility that needs to go alongside the technical measures. And look, I mean, I think I'm still on the side of probably the doomers rather than the optimists in terms of our ability to defend these systems and networks, right? How much money and how much of an investment are we going to need to put in to secure these vast social media sites? How much of an investment is it going to be required across our government to secure the Electoral Commission and all of our government ministries and services? I think at the moment, unfortunately, the adversaries are in the ascendancy, and we're seeing the attacker is prevailing over our ability to defend. So, I mean, I think this is a long-term resource question for governments as well as the tech sector, and I'm not entirely optimistic about the progress that's been made, unfortunately.
Right. Can I add one thing about the Munich Accord? Yeah. I think it's quite important. I mean, the tech companies themselves in the accord admit that their defences only go so far, right? I mean, in terms of helping people identify artificially generated content, they say that if you talk about things like watermarking, classifiers, but none of those things on their own or collectively, the accord says, will actually guarantee that you can actually do this accurately.
Can you just explain what watermarking and classifiers are?
Well, watermarking is, if you put a watermark on something, you see, so you basically sort of give a visual indication of how I could either say something, this is artificially generated, or it could say something is real. But the point is that the accord itself says that it also has to rely on public education. I think that's really important, things like media literacy. And the problem at the moment is that in this country, at least, we are essentially asking the tech companies to mark their own homework. And I think I would argue that if we are going to regulate the distribution of information on the internet, and we need to think very carefully about that in terms of challenges on freedom of expression, I would rather that regulation was done by elected representatives than by tech companies in California or in Beijing.
Yeah, no, I mean, that relates to a question we've got here online, which is, you know, at what point does the technology pose such a threat that we might justify more extensive intervention by the state? And we've got another question from Anonymous, maybe one of your colleagues, Louise. Could you give some examples of how you might intervene? So I'm really interested in this question, question about powers. What powers, you know, optimally would we want, whether it's the Electoral Commission, Ofcom, other regulators, you know, have we got the powers right at the moment? Simon, do you want to come in on powers? What powers would you like others to see? Do you want more powerful regulators?
I was going to start from the point which I completely agree with. So C2PA, content provenance, watermarking absolutely are part of a solution. They're a technical standard which gets you so far. They're necessary but not sufficient, absolutely. And in and of themselves, you even need to have more than one of those initiatives happening. And so there are, the tech accord is about How do we create some of those technical standards which allow for some of that subsequent action to take place? So I completely agree with that point. One good thing, though, about C2PA is that we've got a common standard which the industry is uniting around, so that at least then you've got the potential to for people to identify what, you know, is tagged with a particular standard. What I think we need to move towards, so I completely agree with the point around public awareness, public literacy, and there are things there which should not be for companies, I completely agree, to do. So it's absolutely critical that we adhere to the rule of law, that there are laws, and there's also, you know, a role for government and for civil society that shouldn't be a role for technology companies around public awareness around an election campaign. We can work with civil society organisations, we can partner with government, but completely agree. An optimistic, you know, version of this would be that you've got a public literacy that sort of understands, in the same way as the sort of see it, say it sorted for the tube, or the HTTPS sort of padlock that you know that you're going to a secure website. We need something like that that has the pull through, and that's something we can be part of, you know, the discussion around, but absolutely it needs to be those other stakeholders that are fundamental to that, I agree.
So Chris, would you like more intrusive regulation, more powers, and who would you like to see have more powers? Do you think we need more powers, or?
I think there's clearly a difficult balance, and it is a balance. We need to get the balance right between dealing with potential harms online and protecting people from them, and protecting freedom of expression. So do we need more regulation? I think within that context of always thinking about ways not to restrict freedom of expression, yes, we do. I Full Fact certainly believes that the Online Safety Act is pretty much out of date before it was published. And it's not surprising, because things are moving so quickly. The information environment is changing so rapidly that something you say last week is probably out of date next week. And it's very, very difficult to legislate at a fixed point in time in something which is moving so quickly. But yes, we think that, for example, the Online Safety Act does really nothing to deal with potential harms involving adults. It does a lot for harms involving children online. And this is obviously much broader than the specific issue of elections. But I think we need to take another look at the Online Safety Act, and whoever forms the next government either needs to fairly fundamentally redraw it or come up with new legislation, which also, of course, involves artificial intelligence, because Gen AI is the new thing over the last year or so.
Joe, is there anywhere we should look to for sort of model legislation? Anyone you think has got this righter than we have?
Yeah, well, I was going to mention the European Union, the EU AI Act. I mean, it doesn't seem to be that of a much of a popular approach to AI regulation in the UK, but there's been this quite signatory piece of legislation going through the European Parliament, the EU AI Act, and they...
What's the big difference with the way we're approaching it? What's the...
Well, I think we probably need a similar regulatory or legal framework.
And what does it do? What's the EU?
Well, it categorises the risks posed by AI systems. So it bans some types of AI technology as posing an unacceptable risk, and it places regulations around other forms of technology which are widely used, which may constitute risk. So it's a risk-based framework. It's not. Perfect, but I do think we need to start thinking about how we might actually prohibit certain forms of AI which could lead to major societal harms. I also think the broader point is that we perhaps need to think about shifting the liability or responsibility for when things go wrong with AI technologies. And the approach that's been taken, I think, so far in this country, in the United States, is actually when things go wrong, it's the user of the system, the people or the company that's used the system that's responsible for the harm that's been generated. I think that there's an argument maybe to put back some of the liability or the responsibility back on the developers of the technology. And that would be a significant shift which could have a positive impact. I don't think there's any perfect regulatory frameworks out there, but certainly the EU system is a notable one. And also, you know, obviously it provides like GDPR mechanisms to fine people when things go wrong. And that's not, you know, a perfect thing to do, but levying fines against technology companies or people who deploy AI systems which cause harms can create a major disincentive, and I'm not sure we have the power to do that.
They're quite big fines as well, aren't they?
That yeah, some of the GDPR fines have been huge. I suspect there will be some large fines coming as a result of the EUI Act as well.
And Louise, what can you do if you see this happening? And then we're going to come to questions. What powers do you have now? If you'd like to add, what more powers would you like? That would be great, but tell us what you can do at the moment.
Okay, so as I mentioned, we are, in terms of our regulatory and enforcement powers, we're about well-run elections and we're about political money, basically. So we will be making, for legitimate campaigners, for registered political parties or registered campaigners, we will be making the money they spend on AI in every form public after the UK general election. But I think what is important to remember is that actually in the UK context, how AI, particularly Gen AI, may be used in election campaigning is completely untested. Now, we're talking about the general election, but there are, of course, polls taking place on the 2nd of May across large parts of the UK. And we need to look very carefully at what actually happens in those to build up some evidence for us to be making recommendations about any kind of regime in the future. So there is a little bit, and I know this is really annoying for me to say, a little bit of we need to wait and see because we need to build up an evidence base for any kinds of recommendations that we make. Having said that, one of the things that we have seen in particularly in local elections last year and particularly in Northern Ireland and particularly aimed against women was the use of AI to effectively abuse or intimidate female candidates in the election campaign, up to and including things like deepfake pornography. So actually what is fundamental and can happen now is making sure that the law enforcement around the UK have the investment in their capability and capacity to be able to deal with the abuse and intimidation of campaigners and candidates through the use of AI. I think that's really, really, really important because the moment you start putting off women or people from a black or minority ethnic background, or people with non-heteronormative sexual orientation, the moment you start putting them off, you really lose something from your democracy. So that is essential. In terms of the sorts of powers which we might look at through the evidence that we gather, I think for us, again, it's not so much about what is the truth of what's being said. It's about how transparent is the creation of what's being said. Because actually, you know, we have to be a bit real about politics here. Our politicians are not always going to be nice to each other. You know, they are going to use bar charts that don't actually make sense. And they probably are going to use another party's colour or leaflet colour in some of the stuff they put out. We need to be realistic about that. And that's why, really, it is fundamentally about arming voters. A lot of us have mentioned sort of literacy. To be able to look at these things with that really important critical eye.
And do you see it as your role to do this voter literacy or, you know, leaving it to civil society? People like, full fact, who do you think?
I think that's an interesting one. So we do play a role in public awareness about electoral processes. You may have seen some of our campaigns reminding people to register to vote and also reminding people around voter identification documents that you need to take with you in order to vote. Just get that message in. My comms team will be happy. But this would be an extension. This would be an extension for us. Now, one of the things we do, actually, and we only started this a few years ago, is a lot of educational literacy around our democratic process. We have, for example, an annual Welcome to Your Vote Week, which runs in a lot of schools around the UK, and we produce educational materials for civil education teachers to be able to use that's impartial, that means they're not worried about, you know, being accused of political partiality in the way that they teach. That's very new. It's only been running for a few years. So, you know, there is a precedent there that we might look at, based on the evidence, whether we extend it. But I think it is important for the tech companies to be involved in that. And I think it is important for civil society to be involved in that, because if you don't have that sense of a holistic approach, you risk either falling behind the technology developments, and you risk taking away that sense of responsibility that's already been talked about in the sort of tech companies' approach.
Okay, I'm going to come to questions now. So if you want to ask a question, I'll take them in sort of bunches of three. So let's go, Maddie, just behind you. Yeah, and if you just tell us who you are and make questions quite short, because then we'll try and get everybody in.
Hi, is this on? Francis, I work at DCIT on election security. And I wonder what the panel's thoughts were about the dissemination of misinformation and disinformation in submerged networks. So a lot of the discussion has been about public deepfakes. Okay. So I wonder, what about the dissemination of this information on WhatsApp or Telegram, where it's not as obvious?
Okay. WhatsApp, Telegram, Truth Social, wherever. Actually, Truth Social is public, isn't it? Yes.
Hi, Vincenzo. Just in terms of what the panel think around the lessons that have been learned and effectively implemented from past exposures to digital harms. I'm thinking about COVID and misinformation, disinformation. I'm thinking about the Brexit referendum. Kind of what have we done well out of those back?
Okay, what have we done well? And let's do one more here, and then we'll come to the next crop. Yeah.
Yes. Bjarne Løgum, Christian Dabler, Denmark. It's more for Joe, I think. In those elections we've seen already this year, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Senegal, Portugal, Slovakia, perhaps even Russia. Mm. Is there any scary things in terms of AI propaganda you've seen that you think we should be really worried about?
Okay, fantastically good questions. Chris, I'm going to come to you first on this question about lessons from digital harms elsewhere. You've done a lot at Full Fact, haven't you, about health disinformation, things like that. You covered Brexit from BBC Reality Check, things mm-hmm. sort of set up in response to Brexit. So what lessons should we take from that?
I think one of the lessons is the need not just to fight bad information, but to actively promote good information. Good and bad are subjective terms, I realise, but what I mean by that is accurate information. From a Full Fact perspective, we want as much political debate as possible, but we'd like it to be based on ideally a set of shared facts while acknowledging grey areas, but facts that stand up to some form of statistical scrutiny. And I think it's really important to put forward good information, which means that people have, if you like, a standard that they can look at. So, for example, in advance of the elections, we're going to be doing a lot of pre-bunking as well as debunking, which means making sure, we don't care which way you vote, but if in terms of giving voters an informed choice on the things that matter to them, the more good information we can put out to fight against the bad information, the better. So I think that's one thing that I would certainly take away, certainly from the time at the BBC when I was covering Brexit. All the audience research told us that people just didn't understand the terminology we were using. And when we started talking about the single market and the customs union, most people didn't understand it. And there's no point in rabbiting on about things if you're trying to create an impact in a wider audience if you're talking in a language people don't feel comfortable in. So I think it's about accessibility and transparency.
I'm very into pre-bunking as a word. What about these submerged networks? I know you've been worried in the past, haven't you, about sort of information coming, lack of transparency.
Very worried about them in the Indian election. I know that's not here, but also misinformation about the Indian election circulates quite widely in South Asian communities in the UK, and WhatsApp groups are a big part of that. I don't quite know what the answer is, but yes.
You're not Telegram or WhatsApp, are you? WhatsApp.
I'm not. Yeah, WhatsApp any answers caveated with I'm not speaking for any other platform. Yeah. I was just going to come in quickly on the pre-bunking point, which I think is really important. And a linked lesson learned is that debunking, there is some evidence that debunking may not be so helpful. There are examples of where we've seen deepfakes being propagated, and then the debunking actually has added significantly to the traffic and therefore potentially the impact. So pre-bunking, good. We think there's some evidence that debunking may not be very...
It does go to actually one of the questions I've got, which is, are fact-checkers part of the problem? Don't they fact-check the side they disapprove of more than the other? So even fact-checking is not seen as a sort of neutral activity. Louise, you talked about transparency, but these submerged networks are sort of much harder if I'm passing messages around encrypted networks. Is there anything you can do, or do we just have to accept that that's impossible, or is that back to those relevant platforms?
Well, I mean, it is a lot harder when something is on a closed system rather than publicly available, but there have actually been some changes in the law that do put a bit of a legal framework around this. We'll come back to enforcement of said legal framework. But one of the things that we are really pleased to see and that came in at the back end of last year was what we call digital imprints. So if you get a leaflet through the paper about election campaigning, it will have a little bit of text at the bottom that says produced by X party or candidate, and it will tell you who it's on behalf of. But until back end of last year, actually, that wasn't a requirement on material that was sent online. That is now a requirement across the UK. I'll give a little shout out to Scotland because they had a regime first, but it's now UK-wide. And that does provide some reassurance that actually, whether it's through a closed network, whether it's on WhatsApp, or whether it's on a public network, there should be something telling you actually who did this, which is going to help you then make up your mind whether to let it influence their vote. But I mentioned enforceability. That is, of course, a challenge because, you know, the Commission can only enforce things that we know about and can gather evidence on, likewise the police. And also, and I think it's important to note this, our powers end at the UK's borders. So when you're talking about information that may come into the UK externally, that is a very difficult thing for us to enforce any kind of imprints or any kind of legal framework on campaigners or actors who are outside the UK.
So is this global government pact that Oliver Downing was talking about in Solos, is that designed to help with sort of extraterritorial enforcement or...?
I believe that's what it's designed to, although I can't speak on behalf of the government, just need to make that very clear. But I think for us, this whole area of foreign actors or foreign interference in campaigning itself, so not sort of the cyber attacks, which sadly the Commission is all too familiar with, but actually in campaigning, is quite a challenging area, partly because campaigning by foreign entities is not banned in UK elections. It just has a very, very low financial threshold placed on it instead. So there's a challenge there around how do you enforce something that is allowed but only up to £700, and how do you actually exercise your powers or gather evidence from an organisation that's overseas? How do you try and work with social media platforms, many of whom are also headquartered overseas, in order to try and get the evidence that you would need? So for us as a civil regulator, it's very, very challenging. And if you're then flipping over to law enforcement, you then need to look at how are you funding and supporting law enforcement in the UK to be able to take this on. So I think it is a really challenging area. But I do caveat that by saying what I said right at the start, which is the overwhelming amount of campaign material you see this year will be people who are doing it legitimately because they want to benefit their society. So I think there's just a balance point here around sort of suspicion versus belief.
So,
can I just come back very briefly on the criticism you lobbed at me on fact-checking? I will be brief, but I think it's important to say. We are impartial and we will fact-check all parties, and you'll see that in the election. What we won't do is say, oh, we've done two fact-checks of party A, so we'll do two fact-checks of party B, because that's not impartiality, that's fake balance. So if we think one side is telling more porcupines than the other, we're not afraid to say so.
That's an ex-BBC person there on balance. Anyway,
Answered those questions.
Thanks, Chris. Yes, and I want to go, Joe, what have we seen in these elections? And we've heard about WhatsApp groups, the Indian election, which is upcoming, but what should we work? Anything we should alert to that...
Yeah, look, you mentioned a specific set of elections which I hadn't followed quite closely. Was there something that you'd seen that you...
I was just talking about there has been
other elections. I mean, I think the main pattern across lots of elections is the algorithmic amplification of mis and disinformation. It's the algorithms that salespeople have been directed to false and misleading content, and actually groups are being created on these channels which are vigorously disseminating that information. So I think that's the general pattern. I couldn't comment more specifically on those specific elections. But I mean, I think the pre-bunking thing you know, is really important. It was very notable to me that intelligence agencies came out before the Ukraine war and said, be aware that Russia's going to stage a false flag operation, this is going to happen, and then they weren't able to do that because it had been pre-bunked. So I think that that was a significant thing. And I'd also mention, I spent a lot of time in New Zealand, the Christchurch call after the Christchurch massacres, which relates to the point about submerged networks. You can eliminate far-right extremist content online, but we've also got to be aware of where else these people are communicating, and that's the dark web and encrypted platforms. What do we do about that? And that's where I think, maybe not in respect of WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger or whatever, but these encrypted platforms where people are operating, disseminating hate speech, disseminating this kind of extremist content, disinformation, that's probably where things like our National Cyber Force that's being built up in Lancashire will have a role, actual takedowns of these sites where these sorts of extremist narratives are being purveyed. So I think that's an important point.
Good. I want to do one more round of questions at least, so not very long, so I'm going to do this. So let's go over here. So Maddie, if you can go there, and then, and then back, then along, and then back. I'll take four questions. Right, it's going to be the last.
Thank you very much. Yes. Kingsley here. I wanted to touch on the security angle. So we've seen that developing democracies, illiberal democracies, and even in autocracies have had a lot of experience with misinformation, disinformation. And I want to touch on the extent to which we could see misinformation, disinformation closing the gap between conventional capabilities, states that might not have the power to confront Western democracies head on through the conventional means, but can do so through disinformation and misinformation. Mm. Will we see democracies in the West maybe directing more financial support to teams working in cybersecurity to overcome this challenge?
That's a really interesting question, yes. Could you pass the microphone along? This is a bit of self-help here, yes.
Thank you. My name's Vincent Burke. I'm a communications consultant, freelance journalism. Maybe it's a terribly naive question, but is it not possible that there will come a point where nobody can believe anything that's on social media to do with politics or the election, and actually the mainstream media, such as the BBC, will benefit because it still has a reputation for impartiality, and there has been evidence of that already, that nobody believes anything on social media.
That's interesting. It's very an echo of that one question online. Can we go to the two ladies who wanted to... Yeah, back there. Maddie, I've made you redundant.
Thank you very much. I have a question about the issues that are vulnerable to suffer... fake news or something like that. I'm talking about the gender issues, LGBTI issues, because some part of the political sides, especially the far rights, are using, I'm from Latin America, are using very strong that kind of issues to attack especially some candidate, female candidates and candidates from the diversities.
Okay, well, that's, I think, goes a bit to what Louise was saying about some of the attacks we've seen in Northern Ireland. And final question.
Thank you. My question is for Louise Edwards. I followed with great interest the article that you wrote for The Telegraph, I think it was about this time last year, calling for an update to electoral laws to tackle political disinformation. I'm sure that you're more aware than I am of your counterpart in Ireland and the powers that they will soon have commenced to monitor election-related mis- and disinformation and information manipulation. I suppose my question is that something that would... resolve the issue that you had raised in that article? I mean, I'm aware that those powers that the Irish Commission have wouldn't cover the content that led to the incitement of the Dublin riots in November, for example. But regardless, given the criticism that has been lobbied at Ofcom for this lack of provisions to really do much about this content, is that kind of along the lines of what you would be looking for?
That's a great place to end. So let's take that one up first, since that was specifically addressed to you, Louise. Louise.
Yeah, it comes down to this question again of what's the right way and who's the right organisation to try and tackle disinformation in political campaigning. And you need to start right from first principles with it, because there isn't really a legal framework there at the moment, unless you're getting into other legal frameworks like defamation or public order matters or so forth. I think with the way that the law is going to work in Ireland, I think it's going to be a really interesting experiment, and I think I'd probably like to see how it works before we look at whether it's the right model for us. But one area where I think we can do more and can focus on as the Electoral Commission actually is around the election process itself. You know, we see confusion or people not really understanding the new voter ID requirements, for example, or how to apply for a voter authority card if you don't have one. And last year we did see a little bit, I think, inadvertent rather than malign, inaccurate campaigning around what sorts of ID you needed, for example. I've also seen people say things like, if you want to vote for Party A, you vote on Thursday, but if it's Party B, you vote on Friday. And those sorts of things we can very swiftly and easily deal with. But when it comes to that sort of, that more campaign-based disinformation, it is really, really hard. Now, for us, it does come back to transparency, actually. And what we think is, if we can make people be transparent about how they've generated information and what they've spent on that information and who's done it, that, I think, might well be an area that we need to kind of probe at. Can I just pick up on a couple of the other questions the floor? The first one on the sort of issues-based campaigning, particularly to attack candidates. Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned before, we do see shockingly high numbers of candidates after local elections over the last few years who have experienced abuse or intimidation, a large portion of that online, and some really, really awful instances that we've heard recounted by candidates. That is a major area of concern, not just for ourselves, but also for police forces around the UK.
And are those areas where the platforms refuse to take the content down, does it not meet their, you know, standards of being unacceptable?
I think one of the challenges you have here is that disinformation spreads in seconds and the truth takes an awful lot longer to spread.
Okay.
And it's not even so much always something happening that is putting people off wanting to get involved. It's the fear of something happening. I mean, my 11-year-old son has already been mentioned. God forbid I would want to go into politics, but if I did, I would be really concerned about something around me then impacting on him and impacting on my family, and that might put me off from the start. As it happens, quite a lot of other stuff puts me off. But, you know, that might well be something that even makes me kind of self-censor my desire to go into it in the first place. This is a really, really big issue, for particularly for sort of law enforcement, but also for campaigners to really take responsibility for the way that they talk to their volunteers and the way that they talk to their own members. And the way that they talk publicly to make it really clear that this sort of abuse can't happen. And I give a shout out actually to a report that was done by the Joe Cox Civility Commission, which was run by the Joe Cox Foundation, which made some really, really landmark recommendations in this area. And one of the things that it stresses and that I want to stress as well is when it comes to abuse and intimidation, you cannot expect it to be solved by the victims changing their behaviour. You have to look at the people and the drivers who are doing this and get them to change. It shouldn't be on potential victims to then decide to do something different themselves to keep them safe. One other thing I just really wanted to pick up on, the sort of, can no one believe anything online before? I can see how you get there as a sort of, you know, taking a logical progression through it. I don't personally believe we're ever going to go quite that far. I think there is healthy scepticism around information online, and I think that's very, very sensible. But I do want to really emphasise that, you know, democracy is so vital to the way that we organise ourselves, the way that we run our country, the way that we think about society. And it is something that we need to protect and to cherish. And we need to bring that balance to everything that we do in this space between protecting against the threats, but feeling appropriately reassured that you can have confidence, you can go and vote with confidence. Most people who campaign are doing it perfectly legitimately. And when it comes to elections, whether it's the general election or the May polls, you know, if you have a right to vote, get out there, get registered and make a difference.
OK, well, that's a very rousing end. But I'm not going to end there because I want to give my other panellists some right. Simon, just coming to you about sort of attacks and things like that. And the picture Louise has painted of, you know, things spreading extremely quickly. I mean, is this an area where AI can actually help in take down or not let that stuff onto those platforms in the first place? Or
I think it is.
And there's a speed response.
Yeah, a couple of points. So linked to this, and I think it links to the point about the philosophical question of can people trust anything. I think it is actually critical that we, because there is an argument that people can't trust anything and therefore we need to be careful about drawing attention to some of these issues. I actually think that the more transparency, the more that we can use the technology to defend through things like using AI to detect, encourage people to report and those kind of things. That's a critical part of the answer. So I actually think that more transparency, more understanding of the technology and using things like content provenance technology. It's good that the BBC as well as social media companies have signed up to C2PA as a content provenance standard. So I think more transparency, more awareness of what the technology can do is a good thing, and we shouldn't shy away from that for fear that that will kind of put people off. Another linked point, and it goes back to the point about submerged networks, is we have to remember that AI is not the only issue here. This is about persistent online manipulation from a set of actors who are using all kinds of different techniques, and they will use AI as a tool, they'll use lots of other tools. And so we have to focus on that and the methods that they're using. Sometimes these are deep fakes when we've seen them, sometimes they're pretty shallow fakes, sometimes they're combined with other techniques as well. And so we have to think about how do we tackle the kinds of manipulation that are trying to happen, whether it's happening in submerged networks. Often what we see in the pull-through into social media is the tip of the iceberg of a much wider set of activity in networks, pre-positioning of content on all kinds of different networks. So we have to look at all of those different techniques that are being used and how we use technology to tackle all of that, rather than just seeing the kind of piece at the end.
Joe, we haven't dealt with the question here about, you know, what sort of assistance can we give, you know, sort of imbalance between capability in different countries?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hugely important question. I mean, I think that increasingly what I've seen the last decade or so is, in terms of assistance to developing countries for AI is, you know, assistance for cybersecurity being mainstreamed into development processes. So you now have the development agencies giving assistance to countries to enhance their maturity around this technology. That needs to happen for AI as well. But I think also the question was about sort of AI being used as this asymmetric tool, right, by powers that want to sow divides. And I think that that's very pertinent. One of the things I'm doing some work on at the moment is this idea of data poisoning, right? Actually manipulating the data that the algorithm is trained on or relies on. That's a very asymmetric way of actually manipulating and corrupting an algorithm in the way it works. So we do have to think about what's the low-hanging fruit for adversaries in terms of how they can actually attack the AI system, make it not work properly, and do that in a way that causes social harm. So I think that this is something we need to pay a lot of attention to. I did really just want to respond as well to the lady's question here as well. One of the examples that really struck me in relation to what the wedge issues are was how the Black Lives Matter movement was portrayed in America, and that group, through a concerted attempt on, again, social media, the use of disinformation and algorithmic manipulation, that group was vilified and sort of cast as this extremist organisation that wanted to bring down America and abolish the police. So when we had this organisation who was fighting for, you know, justice in the context of, you know, awful police violence against African Americans, algorithms were used to really discredit that organisation. And it's those wedge issues, whether it's gender, race, Gaza, Ukraine, you know, think about the recent Russian operation to leak the conversation about German support to Ukraine and the controversy that's caused within the Western alliance. It's those wedge issues that we need to be much more concerned about. And I look at our politics now in the UK, and we are in very divisive times, whether it's, you know, racial issues or gender issues. And those are the things that are going to be exploited. And it also relates to the question about, well, who do we trust now? That one thing that I think is really important to understand is we've had a big diversification of our media environment. So that our traditional trusted sources of news, you know, whether that's the New York Times or the BBC, they're not trusted, I don't think, in the way that they were 10, 15 years ago. And people are able to get information from, you know, YouTube influencers and purveyors of conspiracy theories, you know, the dark web, chat rooms, you know, and that reinforces people's cognitive biases and their pre-existing assumptions about the way our society works. So I think it's the diversification of the media landscape that plays into the vulnerabilities we're seeing around AI as well.
So, Chris, you touched at the start about the positive role AI could play, very quickly on the positive role, but also given your BBC heritage, you know, are we going to see the reversion back to mainstream media as your trusted source when you can't trust anything online?
So I'm pleased to hear the Electoral Commission is optimistic about what people believe and trust. But I'm sure Louise would agree we can't be complacent. I mean, I've only been at Full Fact for 5 months. But when it was set up 15 years ago, it was basically set up to answer the question, why is this man, and it usually was a man, lying to me? I think it's now increasingly trying to address the question, can I believe anything I see or hear or read anywhere? And I rather like Joe, I wouldn't necessarily differentiate between online information and the rest of the media. I think there's a general distrust creeping in across the board. And when I look at this year's election, I think it's highly unlikely that any AI deepfake will change the course of our election. Perhaps it's more likely in the US if it comes down to, in a very close election, to a few thousand votes in Pennsylvania or Georgia again. But what it could do here is further diminish trust and therefore possibly diminish legitimacy. I agree with Louise that healthy scepticism is really important, but I think we're quite close to a tipping point where healthy scepticism becomes something where the system is less and less trusted, and that's a bad thing.
Oh dear, I hope you were going to end on an optimistic note there, Chris.
Sorry.
But anyway, but I am going to close it there. So I'm going to ask you, first of all, to thank our fantastic panel. And thank you. Thanks very much for your watching online, for sending in your questions. I'm going to do the really annoying bit now. You can watch again. You can sit and watch this all evening on repeat. Everybody in the room, if you'd like to join us for a drink next door, please do. So thank you all very, very much for coming. And thank you particularly for the University of Lancaster for helping us with this event. And it's been a really excellent collaboration. Thanks, Joe.